A big, beautiful Christmas present today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Congressional Republicans released their plan for cutting taxes. President Trump calls it a gift.
We will provide a massive tax cut for American families. We will make the tax code simpler and fair.
Yeah, but not this simple.
The Netherlands, it takes 15 minutes to file your taxes. In Britain, they send you a card and say, here's what we think your taxes are. If you like it, you check it, and you're done in 1 minute.
Plus, New Zealand considers special visas for climate refugees. But this woman from the Pacific Island nation of Kiribati says,
It's a last option. And if it's a last option, let's do everything we can do right now to remain in Kiribati.
Those stories, plus a global view on the upcoming Lion King remake, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. You know, few things are certain in life. One certainty, though, is that humans across the globe will always have many different views on what's a fair tax system. Today, Republicans in Congress unveiled their latest proposal to overhaul the U.S. tax code, and President Trump kind of liked it.
We will provide a massive tax cut for American families. We will make the tax code simpler and fair. It's called simplification. We will restore our competitive edge by reducing business taxes for the first time in more than 30 years. And we will bring back trillions and trillions of dollars that's now parked overseas so that money can be put to work rebuilding the United States of America as opposed to rebuilding other parts of the world.
We'll get to that last point in a moment. Of course, there are already a wide range of views out there on the pros and cons of this proposed overhaul. And let's remember, regardless of how we do taxes, other countries do it differently. We're going to dive right into that fiscal soup now with T.R. Reid. His latest book is A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. T.R. Reid says the Republicans' proposal to cut the corporate tax rate from 35 to 20% sounds like a good idea.
We have the highest nominal rate of any country, and even the effective rate, that is what they actually pay after their accountants do all their tricks, is higher than in most countries. So that's a competitive disadvantage to American corporations. So cutting that rate makes sense. But, you know, Marco, I don't think it's going to work.
Why not?
Well, they want to cut the rate to 20%. And a lot of countries like us already have rates lower than that. Ireland, Germany, Switzerland. Bermuda has a zero tax rate. That's why there's a company called Google Bermuda Holdings. We're never going to get down to that level. So I don't know that cutting this tax rate is going to stop American companies from moving profits overseas.
Well, we heard President Trump a moment ago saying pretty confidently that this proposal will bring back trillions and trillions of dollars parked overseas. Does that seem likely?
There's about $2.5 to $3 trillion of American money that is ostensibly overseas. It's probably in New York banks, but they can say it's overseas. When they bring it home, they have to pay the corporate tax on it. This plan gives them a much lower rate. We don't know what it's going to be yet, but it cuts the rate by about two-thirds. So yeah, some companies will take advantage of that and bring the money home. And you know, Marco, we did that in 2004, and they said they were going to use all this money for investment and wages. No, they gave it all to their investors.
On the whole, though, does this plan today look to you like the populist tax cut that candidate Trump promised?
Well, rich people are the biggest winners in this. And it doesn't have, you know, they say, well, anytime you cut taxes, rich people are going to pay less because they pay the most taxes. I see that. But it doesn't have to be that way. You can structure a tax cut so that most of it goes to people at the median income, about $56,000 or less. They've structured this one so rich people are really big winners. Just eliminating the estate tax would save the Trump family about $1 billion. That's not a bad deal for them.
Wow. How do these sorts of changes proposed today here in the U.S. stack up against global trends when it comes to tax policy? Are we going in a pattern with everybody else?
You know, the rhetoric, I think, sounded good. What the Republicans have said is we want a simple plan. The chairman of the Ways and Means Committee held up this postcard. We want to eliminate all sorts of deductions and exemptions, make it easier for people to pay. And they're doing that to some degree. It's not going to be as simple as it is in other countries. In the Netherlands, it takes 15 minutes to file your taxes. In Britain, they send you a card and say, here's what we think your taxes are. If you like it, you check it, and you're done in 1 minute. And we're just not going to get that simple. And the reason is all the complications, the deductions and exemptions, they all have strong lobbyists defending them. So we should get to the level of simplicity of Germany, Netherlands, Japan, or Britain, but we're not going to do it with this bill.
As long as lobbyists are in Washington, it sounds like nothing will change. Is that what you're saying?
Well, there's a way to do it. In 1986, we got rid of hundreds of exemptions and deductions. And what they did was when the lobbyists came in, they said, God, if I give you your client your deduction, then I got to give Mary's client her deduction. I'm not giving them to anybody. What you argue is no deductions, no exemptions, and then I can lower everybody's tax rate. But if you give it to one industry, then it gets harder to say no to the others.
Yeah, so big bonuses for the rich under this plan, and income inequality in the U.S. has increased so dramatically in recent decades. Where in the world do you look to for success stories in using the tax structure to shrink income inequality?
All the Scandinavian countries have done it because they tax the rich very sharply, and then they use those revenues to provide health care, education, and jobs for people at lower income, and that offsets inequality. About 11 countries, France is the world champion, tax all your wealth. And if the total comes up to more than 1.5 million euros.
Yeah, it's about $1.75 million.
They tax you 1% on the whole thing. Well, guess what? That makes the rich pay into the government, which can then provide programs for poor people. And that offsets inequality.
I mean, it's an interesting idea. Can you imagine that happening in the U.S.?
Not with the power of the rich now. I mean, getting rid of the estate tax sharply increases inequality in America. One thing about the estate tax is, you know, you don't pay the estate tax for money you work for. It's only if you were a lucky rich kid and inherited more than $11 million. My view is if somebody's lucky enough to inherit $50 million, let her pay 10 or 15 million in tax to build hospitals and help veterans. She'll still have $30 million left to ride around in a Rolls Royce.
So, TR, what countries do you think the U.S. should be looking to realistically for inspiration for a better tax code?
Well, Australia and New Zealand have done a great job of eliminating deductions, credits, exemptions, loopholes, and therefore you can raise the same amount of tax at lower rates. Britain has a great idea. In Britain, they have an Office of Tax Simplification. And if that office thinks that some rule or regulation or form is too complicated, they have the power to change it to make it simpler.
So just finally, because there's one aside I really loved in your book, the description of how the tax code in Slovakia affects lawmakers there. They don't get a tax break, do they?
No. So in our country, Congress has given itself all sorts of tax breaks that nobody but a member of Congress gets. In Slovakia, they did the opposite. They said any member of the parliament or the cabinet has to pay tax at a rate 5% higher than anybody else of the same income. In other words, if they raise taxes, they get hit the worst.
I don't see that sneaking into the Republican tax plan.
We ought to do that in the U.S., don't you think, Marco? We ought to do that.
Lovely.
One. Yeah.
T.R. Reid's latest book is A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. Good to speak with you, T.R. Thank you.
Good, Marco. Thanks.
When it comes to taxes, watch out. It can get crazy, especially when the country is Fredonia.
Something must be done. War would mean a prohibitive increase in our taxes.
Hey, I got an uncle lives in Texas.
No, I'm talking about taxes, money, dollars.
Dallas, that's where my uncle lives. Dallas, Texas.
Yeah, the Marx Brothers and Duck Soup. Well, how did we get here? We thought it would be a good idea for our history guy, Chris Wolf, to give us a history of taxation. Chris, where does taxation actually come from? Like, how far back does it go?
Well, I think, Marco, you could probably argue that it's an intrinsic part of all human societies from the dawn of time. And of course, it brings to mind that old saying made famous by Benjamin Franklin, who wrote that in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes.
Yeah, so why are taxes so certain as death? How did that start?
It's as much philosophy and sociology as it is history, Marco. But if you look at the simplest human societies that are extant today, the hunter-gatherers still found in the remotest parts of the world, the survival of the band depends on the members pooling their resources to basically protect the weak and the vulnerable. Mm.
Yeah, so like taxes for a hunter-gatherer back in the day, that would have been what, like a bean?
Well, it's more likely you're talking a very small group. So you could say, okay, this guy is a good hunter, but he's sick. So let's all share our food and look after him until he gets better. And there's a collective contribution to the survival of the group. And then, of course, once agriculture comes along and you get the creation of food surpluses, all societies find ways to provide for people who are deemed, in a sense, useful enough to get out of the business of producing food. Craftsmen, of course, craftswomen, but also a class of priests, military types, and eventually a class of administrators. And someone's got to figure out how to pay that.
Yeah. So how did, like, early societies first figure out who pays what?
Well, of course, those decisions over who pays, how much they pay, how it gets spent, those are some of the prime causes of conflict. So it's not easy. But the answer is, if you want to be philosophical about it, politics at its most fundamental level. Mm. It's the mechanism for resolving those kind of conflicts, or at least attempting to, because immediately there's power dynamics at play.
I'm just curious why in America, I mean, the idea of pooling resources, it's a good thing, except when the King of England is overtaxing you. How did taxes become such a dirty word in the United States?
I think it probably is rooted in that early resistance, which kind of defined the identity and nature of the United States. It's the resistance to the imposition of this external levy.
So everybody's talking about income taxes now. How new is the whole concept of an income tax?
It's pretty new, actually. The old ways of raising revenue are direct taxes on land or more specifically on trade. Income tax has always been hugely unpopular. It was first tried in the United Kingdom during the Napoleonic Wars as an emergency war measure to try and pay for a war of survival. But it was hugely unpopular, so much so that when it was repealed immediately after the end of the war, there was thunderous applause in Parliament, which ordered the destruction of all documents related to the income tax.
That's in the UK, right? What about in the United States?
Well, in America, it was even later, and there's a very specific constitutional reason for that. There was an emergency levy during the Civil War, again, for a national war of survival. But Congress didn't try again until 1894, and it immediately ran into legal and constitutional challenges because the Constitution explicitly prohibits taxes being raised without being apportioned according to the census. Mm-hmm. And an income tax inherently is a relationship between an individual and the government and has nothing to do with the states. So the Supreme Court actually threw that out in 1895, and it took an amendment to the Constitution, the 16th Amendment, to actually allow income tax to start in 1913.
And since then, how have income tax rates changed?
Well, 1913 came just in time for World War I, and it very quickly went from about 3% to 77%.
Wow.
For top earners. But wait, it gets much better. In World War II, it peaks out at 90% in 1945, reaching 94% for top earners, for people earning at that time over $200,000 a year, which is $2 to $3 million in today's money.
So when Donald Trump talks about the United States being the most taxed country in the world, he's thinking like 70 years ago.
Correct. And you've got to actually remember the social context for the introduction of income tax, because the world was seething with anger. There was these masses of very poorly paid and poorly treated industrial workers, miners, agricultural workers, very real fear of violent socialist revolution. And, that kind of pressure encouraged the elites to agree to give up a little bit of their money.
Yeah, so just refresh our memory. When did those high income tax rates for high earners start coming down?
Well, it was above 90% for many years and then gradually tapered down to about 70% under Kennedy. The effective rate obviously is a little lower, but it wasn't really until the Reagan tax reforms that you really get the big jump. And of course, then the return to large-scale income disparity in this country.
So death and taxes, they're both certain. So is the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, coming in the studio and teaching us something. Thanks very much, Chris.
You're welcome, Marco.
One super excited Lion King fan in South Africa. That's who I'm talking to next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. You know what? Forget that new tax bill in Congress. For many people, the bigger news today was Disney's unveiling of the cast for its remake of The Lion King.
Hey, kid, what's eating you?
I don't want to talk about it.
He looks blue.
I'd say brownish gold.
No. I mean, he's depressed.
Anything we can do?
Not unless you can change the past.
That's from the trailer for the 1994 original. The remake isn't due out until 2019, but Lion King fans are already psyched because Disney has lined up some big names to voice the characters, like Donald Glover as the hero Simba, James Earl Jones returns as his father, Mufasa, Seth Rogen and John Oliver have also signed on, and, wait for it, Beyoncé as Nala. That news totally lit up social media today. One super excited Lion King fan is Tinashe Venga. He's an entertainment reporter based in Johannesburg, South Africa. Why is this so big for you, Tinashe?
I've been a lifelong fan. I think my relationship with The Lion King began when I was just 4 years old. It was the first movie I ever got to watch in cinema. And since then, I can tell you without fail, I have seen it at least once a year. I know the lines quite well, but I'm not going to recite them on radio because I get lost in it. But I fell in love with every single character, and I think it was an excellent film with a genuinely great story that has managed to live through the ages. To see it coming back in such a spectacular way with a cast that today's generation will certainly be able to relate to is very, very exciting for me. And on top of that, I'm a big fan of Donald Glover's. As soon as he was confirmed for the live-action remake, I lost my mind. And then Beyoncé, on top of that, I think I needed to report this to my medical aid because it was a little bit too much of a shock for me.
Wow, you are a super fan, and the movie isn't even out yet. Do you own the DVD of the original?
I've got a digital version right now, so whenever I feel a little bit down or I feel like I've lost my way, I know it sounds extremely cliche, but I feel like the movie tells great stories about friendship and bonding with parents and the importance of family and honesty and integrity. Those lessons, I find, somehow guide me because when I get lost, I just return to The Lion King and I find my way again.
I got to say, I mean, your story is somewhat surprising because you grew up on the continent. You know the reality of life on the ground versus the way animated Hollywood sees it. What is so appealing about a Disneyfied version of Africa?
I think one of the things that they captured really well about growing up in Africa is the fact that a lot of young people have to grow up very quickly. And for a number of circumstances, a lot of young people either have to experience loss or deal with the idea of loss from a very young age. So I remember being 4 and seeing Simba lose his father, Mufasa. And then again, when I was 5, when I finally got the VHS, I cried every single time throughout that scene. And I thought my parents would come and hug me and say, it's okay, don't worry, it's just a movie. But my mom was very frank and said, this is life. You experience loss and you just need to know that it is a part of life, but it doesn't have to break you. And the way that Simba goes on to find himself is reminiscent of the strength that I've seen in a lot of young Africans who experience loss at a young age, but go on to still do remarkable things with only the hope that I wish my parents were here to still see me, and maybe the belief that somewhere in the stars, perhaps they are watching and guiding us with our every step.
So I'm just curious, how would you respond to, you know, like the Africa is a country types who say, you know, Disney is just divorced from reality?
I think one thing that Disney did extremely well was make The Lion King feel quite regional. And I hope that comes across the same in the reboot, because when I look at what looks like the wildlife and the animals, I mean, you would see those typical animals in that part of Africa, but they never made it look like it was just one region. And I don't think that The Lion King's purpose was a geographical lesson. I think it was just a story that happened to be set in a part of the world. And I think in Africa, I haven't heard too many complaints about the way that Africa is portrayed compared to, you know, perhaps comments made by other celebrities in the past. And I don't think Disney has anything to worry about in that regard.
That's interesting. I mean, I was assuming that you just saw this as escapism, but you actually see kind of integrity in The Lion King.
One thing that I've always enjoyed about watching a lot of Disney's animated films, especially the recent Pixar films, is that they take you to different places that you probably wouldn't have had the chance to go or see in your lifetime. I've never felt as if they disrespected the location they were at. It never felt stereotypical, even though it took place in an African jungle and the animals could talk. I felt like they did the sufficient research to see, okay, at a certain time of year, animals migrate. So let's make sure that we picture that and make it a part of the storyline. And you're likely to see lions and hyenas in the same habitat. And that's what this habitat would probably look like. Let's capture it as accurately as possible. So I feel like if anything, Disney has respected every single location it's gone to. And I'm not saying that as a fan or an ambassador, but that's the impression that I've gotten when I watch the films.
All right. So full disclosure, my kid loved this movie and some of the tropes have kind of been embossed in my brain. Are you a Be Prepared or a Hakuna Matata type?
I'm definitely a Hakuna Matata type. I believe in the happy ending that's just beyond the horizon. And I believe that you do have to keep going. And I always feel very tense during the first half of the movie because I'm like, I know what's coming. I know what's coming. That loss is coming. And then as soon as Timon and Pumbaa appear, I feel the sigh of relief. I feel my shoulders loosening. And I realize that with every challenge and obstacle, for sure, be prepared by all means, but there is always a way around it and there is growth at the end of the tunnel.
Tinashe Venge, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you very much for having me.
Entertainment reporter Tinashe Venge there, joining us from Johannesburg, South Africa. A reggae version of the song from The Lion King, Hakuna Matata, courtesy of Bob Marley's longtime collaborator, Bunny Wailer. And here's some reggae from another part of the world. This is the Black Seeds from New Zealand. I've been wanting you to hear them since I got this new CD of theirs called Fabric. Actually, today, this particular song, Moving On, is apt, because coming up in the next part of the show, a plan the New Zealand government has to offer special visas to people who may be forced to be moving on because of climate change. Only problem, a lot of so-called climate refugees are happy just where they are. That's coming up in a few minutes. First, though, here's some more from the Black Seeds. That's new music from New Zealand's The Black Seeds, a track called Moving On from their new album Fabric. Some critics call The Black Seeds the best reggae band in the world, but I leave that to you to decide. News headlines are next. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Meet Saudi Arabia's newest citizen.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot from Hanson Robotics.
Not everyone approves.
It's very hard for humans to get Saudi citizenship, and here comes this robot, not even made in the kingdom or by Saudis, and she gets a citizenship.
That story's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. As we learned with our last election, a change at the top can make all the difference. Another good example right now, New Zealand. They've got a new Labour government, and they're now proposing something the country hadn't done before, creating a visa category that allows residents of Pacific Island nations to move to New Zealand when they're displaced from their homes by climate change. Mattia Merkusich is a documentary producer who grew up in New Zealand, and she spent the past month in Kiribati, where she's been interviewing people about life in a time of rising seas. Her reporting makes her think that the issue of climate refugees is more complicated than New Zealand might think. So, Mattia, thanks for being here. What exactly is New Zealand considering, and why is that so important for countries affected by climate change right now?
So New Zealand's proposing a humanitarian visa that would essentially help people who are displaced by climate change in the Pacific region. That's quite unprecedented. In fact, the 1951 Refugee Convention, like, specifically does not cover people who are forced from their homes due to climate change. And what New Zealand is doing here is they're potentially trying to address that protection gap through a regional agreement. People have been quick to point out that 100 places per year, which is what they have proposed, won't address the scale of the problem. This number could likely balloon in the future.
Well, let's get a sense of what it looks like on the ground for people who are threatened by climate change. You've been in Kiribati. How's climate change playing out there? What did you see?
What's interesting is the difference between what you see represented in the media and what you see on the ground in Kiribati. From the air, Kiribati's islands kind of look like these polished geodes. There's this like painfully thin crust of land, and you see a glassy lagoon inside. It looks really fragile. Mm. Seeing that makes you believe that this equatorial island could be the canary in the coal mine for climate migration. But what you see at a distance can sometimes be misleading.
In what way?
Well, when I got out my microphone and asked people in Kiribati how they felt about migrating across borders, particularly because of climate change, time and time again, I got this common refrain, and that was, I don't want to move. Mm. I don't want to move. You know, for example, I interviewed Pelanise Alofa, who is the national coordinator of the Kiribati Climate Action Network. And for her, migration is a measure of absolute last resort.
Yeah, let's hear from her real quick.
It's a last option. And if it's a last option, let's do everything we can do right now to remain in Kiribati.
If leaving is their very last option, is there an assumption in New Zealand that, of course, people will want to come here? Because many people just want to stay where they are, right?
Exactly. You know, a lot of people feel like this idea of the climate refugee, this idea of a victim of a foregone climate conclusion, they feel like it eclipses their narrative of wanting to fight to stay. One of the things that Pelanise Alofa told me is that essentially the international community should first and foremost be focusing on radically curbing CO2 emissions.
You kind of tipped to this earlier, but there's also a fairly tight legal definition of refugee that mostly revolves around people being persecuted by their home countries, which plays into this whole debate. Let's hear again from Pelanise Alofa, the national coordinator for the Kiribati Climate Action Network.
I do not know, but somehow in the Pacific Island, the word refugee has a very bad connotation. It's related to something that you have created yourself, you and your country and everybody. But climate change, no, I have nothing to do with it. So don't call me a refugee. Call me something else, a better name.
I'm just curious, I mean, briefly, when you spoke with people, how did they see their future? I mean, are they hopeful that they'll never have to resort to kind of taking a visa for climate change to New Zealand?
What's really noticeable about being in Kiribati is there is a deep love for the land. And most people can't imagine leaving it. It's entwined within culture and it's entwined within people's idea of where they come from. So most people you talk to can't imagine leaving their home.
Documentary producer Mattia Merkusic has spent a month in the Pacific Island nation of Kiribati. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Marco.
So if Kiribati is facing big questions about whether people should stay or go across the Pacific, and the Galapagos Islands are facing a different challenge, how many people can the islands support? Specifically, how many tourists? The island's spectacular landscape and unique wildlife have drawn visitors since the days of Charles Darwin, but the ecosystem there is extremely fragile, so managing the impact of tourists is crucial. Reporter Tipa Fernandez recently visited the Galapagos to find out how they're doing.
It's very early on a cool July morning. The ocean is bien brava today, rough. But that won't stop a dozen or so international divers from taking a dream trip to descend 85 feet, an oxygen tank strapped to their back, to witness hammerhead sharks in their natural habitat.
My name is Claudia and I'm going to be one of the dive masters today.
Tourists come to the Galapagos Islands from all over the world.
My name is Leonard, I'm from Austria, and I want to see the hammerheads.
And most are coming here for the wildlife. rare species of animals and birds that don't seem afraid of humans and are all over the place.
So, guys, Matthias, who owns the dive center.
How are you, folks?
Matthias Espinosa is German-Ecuadorian and came to the Galapagos in 1988. He runs this dive shop, which takes tourists out to the depths of the ocean. His speciality? Hammerhead sharks. It's what all these divers are here for.
Gordon Rocks, for you, is going to be maybe one of the best dives that you're going to have because that's a tough cone.
Espinosa is briefing the divers ahead of their trip.
What is a tough cone? A tough cone is a sediment of ashes. Because of a strong eruption, those ashes went up into the sky and they settled down in form of a cone.
Which makes a unique habitat for underwater wildlife, a rare treat for worldly divers. But it's also fragile.
The question on this very fragile ecosystem is how you can do a tourism on long term that's not going to affect the wildlife here.
So his tours guide the divers very carefully to not cause harm to the underwater world. But Espinosa is also worried about a different threat that comes from the tourism influx, what might sail in on the cargo ships supplying the hotels and tour boats.
With the cargo ships, you can have insects that are hurting right now the ecosystem.
Like what happened to the famous Galapagos finch species when the Phalaenus downsii fly found its way to the islands. It was one destructive fly, Espinosa says.
They are sucking their blood. Some species of finches are suffering a mortality of 90% of that.
So the Ecuadorian government has gotten very strict. What can be brought on and off the islands, even between islands, is vigilantly monitored. So too is the people flow from mainland Ecuador.
Since I've been here, I've seen a lot of changes in the local community just within 16 years.
Stuart Banks is an oceanographer with Conservation International. While the local population is under 30,000, the number of tourists that come, and last year it was over 200,000, may put the most stress on the islands.
But luckily, because of steps that have been taken in the development of the islands, protecting the natural park in Galapagos, the great part of the natural ecosystem is still pretty much as it was 200 years ago, before all of this rapid development.
In fact, 97% of the islands are protected national park lands, where no one is allowed to live or build. While tourists can visit some of these areas with a certified guide, human traffic on much of the Galapagos Islands is minimal, helping with the preservation.
Hola, Depa.
Jonathan Romero is a Galapagos National Park veteran.
Sí, lo más importante es proteger la biodiversidad que tenemos.
He describes his job as working to protect the island's biodiversity.
Sí, nos afecta un grado un poco.
And he calls bad tourist behaviors a severe threat to the islands. Firstly, he says, many tourists don't know how to minimize their impact. They don't know national park rules. They are also not very frugal with electricity usage. And unlike Galapagueños, who don't use plastic bags, tourists often demand them. And some tourists, he says, just don't think.
Justamente una chica que no es de acá vino, había subido montado sobre una tortuga.
He's telling me about a tourist who posted a photo of herself on top of a tortoise to her social media networks. National park rules make clear to all tourists, state you cannot go within 6 feet of the wildlife, and you certainly cannot touch the animals. Some locals saw her social media post and responded with their own strong rebukes of her, he says. She apologized. Here at the very laid-back island of Isabela, the largest of the Galapagos Islands, despite the sandy streets, a tourism infrastructure has developed as more foreigners come to see the volcanoes, the pink flamingos, marine turtles.
Me llamo Ramón Martínez, vivo 24 años.
I meet Ramón Martínez at his beachfront hotel, the corner spot close to the mangroves and rock pools. He and his wife started this hotel back when the beachfront was barely developed. It's sometimes hard to meet all the demands of tourists, he tells me. Like hot showers, and often more than once a day. So he installed solar panels. If big hotel chains set up shop on Isabela, they would have to find a way to meet a traveler's every little need. And Martinez worries that the big hotels wouldn't respect the environment. But so far, he says, locals have resisted moves by big tourism to enter Isabela. Locals here see their island as their patrimony, something they must protect and respect. Their island is not for sale, he says. For the world, Deepa Fernandez, Isabela Island, Galapagos.
It is hard to compare the two, but Tuesday's terrorist attack in New York was the deadliest in the city since 9/11. 8 people died and a dozen people badly injured when an attacker barreled a truck down a busy bike lane. The suspect, Saifullo Saipov, is now facing federal terrorism charges. Prosecutors say he appears to have been inspired by violent ISIS videos. Saipov emigrated to the U.S. from Uzbekistan, and in the last few days, a lot of media attention has been focused on that country, with headlines like, "Why does Uzbekistan export so many terrorists?" Experts who know the region find that sort of narrative troubling. And since we here at The World try to clarify things around the globe when they get muddy, let me bring in Edward Lemon. He's with the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. So what has the media gotten wrong about Uzbekistan since the attack?
Well, I think it's fair to say that counter-extremism in Uzbekistan has been used as an excuse by the government to crack down on all manner of opposition voices and pious Muslims within the country. So certainly, it is a bastion of torture. It is a bastion of repression. And I think shedding light on that, as a number of these opinion pieces that have appeared since the attack have done so, I think that is important. And this is an important reality of what is one of the most authoritarian countries in the world. However, I think framing it as an exporter of terrorists or terrorism is misleading.
Yesterday, there was actually an official statement from the government of Uzbekistan stating that after moving to the USA, Saifullo Saipov became introverted, fell under the influence of radical groups. They do say that the head of their country is ready to bring support into the investigation. But, I mean, essentially, that line there, they were disowning him in any connection to radicalization in Uzbekistan. What is your sense of how much radicalization and recruitment happens inside Uzbekistan and in Central Asia more generally?
There is a degree of radicalization and recruitment happening in Central Asia, but the vast majority is outside. You know, individuals who've left their community at home, they've gone into a new environment, they perhaps don't have, they feel marginalized, they don't fit in. I think if we look at Saipov, he came to America, won the green card lottery, and wanted to build a new life here, and you know, he struggled to really find his place in society.
You're saying Saipov was mostly radicalized here in the U.S. Are you basing that on what you know about his story so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Uzbek journalists who've now gone and spoken to his family members and neighbors in Tashkent say that he was from what they describe as a secular family, which is not untypical in post-Soviet Central Asia. They all describe him as being a friendly individual, wasn't particularly interested in religion. But then when we look at the testimonies from his friends since moving to the United States, he never really found his place in society. He was at times aggressive, swearing. The imam at the mosque in Florida, which he attended, said he was late for prayer. He wasn't particularly knowledgeable about Islam. So, you know, seemingly the process by which he's come under the influence of these radical views has happened since moving to America.
And just turning back to Uzbekistan, like terrorist acts there, are they widespread in Uzbekistan and in Central Asia?
No, I mean, I think, you know, although the narrative is that it's a hotbed of extremism and terrorism, we see very few terrorist attacks within the region, certainly when compared to Afghanistan and Pakistan and the Middle East. In fact, many of the instances of terrorism that have occurred in the last 10 years in Central Asia, although they've often been linked by the government to Islamic extremism, these instances are more related to organized crime and sort of local politics and corruption.
So why does Uzbekistan export so many terrorists? That headline I mentioned earlier, how Uzbekistan became a hotbed for violent extremism and radicalism. We've seen these headlines since Tuesday's attack. What is the question you think we should be asking?
I think it's important for us to understand what's happening to Central Asians in these transnational spaces, in these instances after they leave Central Asia. What is there something about the political situation in Central Asia that makes these individuals more susceptible to recruitment by radical groups? And what's specifically happening to them that makes them vulnerable when they've actually left? Given that Islam is so tightly controlled and the narrative around Islam in Uzbekistan is so tightly controlled, generally the level of Islamic awareness for many individuals is quite limited. And when they emigrate, move to a more open environment, many of them rediscover religion as a sort of way of coping with being a migrant. And a very small minority of those individuals gravitate towards a more extreme form of Islam.
Edward Lemon with the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. Thank you.
Thank you.
It wasn't long after Tuesday's vehicle attack in New York that President Trump fired off a series of tweets blasting the visa lottery system. The connection, as we now know, is that the suspect, an immigrant from Uzbekistan, came to the U.S. on a visa obtained through that program, but so do 50,000 other people each year. The visa lottery program was officially enacted by Congress in 1990. Peter Schock is a law professor emeritus at Yale University. He says the visa lottery program was initially created to help one specific group, Irish immigrants.
It was enacted really to serve the political preferences of Ted Kennedy and Bruce Morrison, who were the ranking members of the relevant committees at that time. And those preferences focused on making it easier for Irish people who were in the United States but had overstayed their visas to be eligible for a full green card. So they developed this program. They called it a diversity program because it takes the form of a lottery, and people are eligible for the lottery if they are applying from a country that has had low levels of immigration to the United States during the last 5 years. Lottery winners can have very low qualifications to win these visas, a high school education or 2 years of work experience and a few other things.
But despite the name, the lottery didn't really increase diversity. What went wrong?
The idea would be if you have a lottery including people from countries that are not well represented in our immigration stream, that would be a fair way of attracting such people. I think it's very misleading because, as I say, the Irish were already here in very large numbers, and they stopped applying to come to the United States in the 1980s because Ireland was very prosperous at that time.
Trump has also implied that the diversity lottery doesn't really vet the people who win the visa. What's the truth on that?
No, that's not true. Everyone who comes into this country on a visa is subject to the same vetting process. Now, it may be that the vetting is more intense from certain countries, as Trump has insisted. But if the vetting process works as it's supposed to, there would be no enhanced risk of terrorism suspects coming into the country under these visas. I think it works quite well. We've had very, very few terrorist incidents. This is almost like lightning striking. One would expect that occasionally these terrible actions would occur, notwithstanding a perfect vetting process.
So if you would, I mean, you kind of seem to dismiss, you know, the risk of terrorism. Lay out for us the points why you disagree with the diversity visa lottery.
My objection to the visa is not that it enhances the risk of terrorism, which I think it does not, but rather that it's foolish to select our immigrants on the basis of a coin flip. It's a foolish way to allocate visas that are among the most precious pieces of paper in the world, given the difficulty that people who want to come to the United States have in qualifying. We should decide what our criteria are, but I think they ought to be more focused on skills and English fluency and some other aspects that correlate highly with success in the United States. And if we want to, have a category for people who are not well-educated or not related to people in the United States or not fleeing persecution, then we can define what that category ought to be. But to do it by lottery makes no sense.
What would you put in its place?
The simplest would be to just end the lottery and allocate the 50,000 visas to the existing immigration preference quotas. Another would be to use those 50,000 visas to experiment with recruiting highly qualified immigrants through an auction in which they would bid for the visas, but they would be subject to certain criteria that would ensure that they are otherwise desirable people.
Peter Schock, professor emeritus at Yale Law School and author of One Nation Undecided, Clear Thinking About Five Hard Issues That Divide Us. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So the initial intent of the diversity visa program was to get people of diverse backgrounds to the U.S. And if you want to talk really diverse backgrounds, Saudi Arabia is setting a high bar. It has to do with this voice.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot from Hanson Robotics.
Sophia the robot and Saudi Arabia. Yeah, if you're confused, don't worry. I am too. Thank goodness the world's Shirin Jafar is here to explain.
Hey, Marco.
So what is this all about, Shirin?
Sophia is the first ever robot to be granted citizenship. This was done at a very lavish economic summit last week in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. At one point during the summit, Sophia took the stage. She stood behind the podium and chatted with the host of CNBC, Andrew Ross Sorkin.
And we just learned, Sophia, that you have been now awarded what is going to be the first Saudi citizenship for a robot.
Oh, I would thank very much the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
All right, that didn't sound like a very spontaneous answer. What does Sophia look like, Shirin, and what tasks can she actually do?
Sophia is a woman, as you can tell. She's made by a company called Hanson Robotics, based in Hong Kong. And the makers say she was made to look like Audrey Hepburn.
Really?
But I have to say, I don't really see any resemblance. Maybe that's just me. She's very human-like. She can express emotions. And she's kind of a celebrity. She's been on the Jimmy Fallon show. Charlie Rose has interviewed her. And she's been on the cover of Elle magazine.
Wow, so a celebrity robot. What are people saying about this?
Well, I spoke with Christian Coates Erickson. He's a Middle East fellow at Rice University. And he says this robot thing was really a publicity stunt.
The Crown Prince is appealing to the sort of Silicon Valley tech sectors that the Crown Prince has been moving in over the past 2 years and whose support he is trying to mobilize for investing in Saudi Arabia.
Okay, let me give you some context, Marco. The Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, wants to completely change the economy of the country. Last year, he announced what he calls Vision 2030. And the plan is that by year 2030, Saudi Arabia will no longer be dependent on oil. And to do that, they need to attract foreign investment. And this is what the summit was all about, to attract foreign investment.
Yeah, well, it's a good publicity stunt, but what about people in Saudi, though? How are they seeing this robot getting treated like a VIP, actual human being?
Well, you know, a lot of people are actually outraged about this because it's very hard for humans to get Saudi citizenship. And here comes this robot, not even made in the kingdom or even by Saudis, and she gets a citizenship. And then some people raise this question, is it okay to give robots rights, like human rights? I spoke with Kate Darling about this. She's a researcher at the MIT Media Lab. I asked her if she, as a researcher, thinks if these kinds of PR tactics have any consequences on our relationships with robots.
I don't think this has any consequences, really. The robots that we have today are really just very, very primitive machines that are, you know, much dumber than insects even. And so I think that conversations about civil rights or, you know, these machines inherently deserving any kind of right is pretty far away from where we are currently.
Yeah, but as we head more and more into the world of artificial intelligence, I can see this all getting pretty complicated, not just in Saudi Arabia. The world's Shirin Jafari, thank you so much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
And that is our show for today. I'm Marco Werman. We Real Humans will be back with you tomorrow from the Nan Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.